for listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
One of the most memorable lines in the movie The Graduate was Mr. McGuire's advice to Benjamin Braddock, "I've just got one word for you, plastic." And it was good advice at the time. When it was invented, plastic was seen as the wave of the future, and a bright, modern, attractive future it was. But in the decades that followed, its limiting qualities became more apparent, and many began to look upon plastic as a social and environmental blight. And the future it was creating looked to be both unnatural and ultimately unsustainable. 60 years ago, relatively few items were made of plastic. Today it can be found everywhere, even in trace amounts in our bodies. Susan Frankel looks at our relationship with this now pervasive material in her new book called Plastic, A Toxic Love Story. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased that it has brought her to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You began your research by trying to spend a day without touching anything plastic. Is that even possible?
I discovered it's not. I mean, yeah, you would think I was writing a book about plastic. I would have known that. And yet, to my surprise, I didn't really think through the idea very hard. Walked into the bathroom on the appointed morning and looked, and there was my plastic toilet seat and, you know, nearby my plastic toothbrush and the plastic bathroom counter.
And you probably write on a plastic keyboard.
No doubt. Absolutely. So I quickly changed my plans, and I decided I'd spend the day writing down everything that I touched that was plastic. And by day's end, I had this enormously long list of things that I knew were plastic and things that I didn't really expect to find were plastic.
Well, do you think that most people are aware of the amount of plastic in their environment?
No, I think it's one of these things that is invisible in its ubiquity. It is so much completely pervasive to our environment that we don't realize it. And I also think that there's so many different kinds of plastics that, you know, we don't necessarily recognize them as such.
Well, it could be used to imitate materials like stone, like wood, like leather, and glass. So that means that it's probably made of all sorts of different things. Is there one thing that all plastics have in common?
Yeah. You know, there are thousands of different kinds of plastics. What they all have in common is they are something called a polymer, which is just a fancy word for meaning a very big molecule. Take something like water. That's a tiny, compact little molecule, you know, two hydrogen atoms, one oxygen atom. Polyethylene is a molecule that's made up of tens of thousands of molecular units that have been kind of linked together in what I sort of think of as daisy chains. And so all plastics have that in common. They are these very big molecules, which we have gotten very good at manipulating in different ways.
What came first, the ability to put all these molecules together or the word plastic?
The ability to put the molecules together. The word plastic, depending on how you define it, it goes back in time. But the first real use of it to refer to a synthetic material really doesn't happen until the early 20th century. And plastics began to be invented in the mid-19th century.
But plastic, initially, is a verb, isn't it, or an adjective?
Yeah, it comes from the Greek to mean, you know, to mold. So, you know, that notion that we were going to have these materials that were very malleable was there for a long time.
Plasticity.
Exactly.
And are all plastics moldable?
In one way or another, but they may be moldable in different fashions. There are some plastics that are molded sort of through a chemical reaction and set that way. There are other plastics. The more common ones are ones that are molded in the process of the chemical reaction that puts the plastic together and can be infinitely molded and melted down and remolded.
Let's talk about a plastic product that pretty much everybody has, a comb. Before there were combs, before there were plastic combs, there were combs. What were they made of?
Well, I use the story of the comb to talk about kind of how plastic changed the kinds of things that we had. So combs had been made of a lot of different materials, but in the 19th century, combs were often made of fairly precious substances like ivory or tortoiseshell. It was, in fact, kind of fears about an impending ivory shortage that led to the development of one of the first early plastics, celluloid. And once that became invented, one of the objects it was often molded into were combs. And so suddenly something like a comb, which had been kind of a costly luxury item, became something that was cheap and anybody could afford it.
So O. Henry's Gift to the Magi, which involves this great sacrifices for a comb, was no longer a problem, although that story was written way after the cellulose that could be used to make a comb was developed, wasn't it?
You know, I can't remember when.
I think it's the early 1900s, and, of course, John Wesley Hyatt developed the plastic that would lead to that, you say, in the in kind of the 1869, if I remember.
1869 was when he developed it. The celluloid industry took off in the late part of the 19th century, and it was still a pretty booming industry. But I say, you know, the gift of the Magus, you couldn't have that story if she hadn't been coveting these beautiful tortoiseshell combs.
Was John Wesley Hyatt a chemist?
No, he was kind of just an amateur inventor. He had invented a knife sharpening machine when he was around 20, and he was just a guy who sort of fancied himself as good with gadgets. And what happened was a billiard ball manufacturer, concerned about the impending shortage of ivory, which was often used to make billiard balls, put up an ad offering $10,000 for anybody who could come up with a viable substitute for ivory. John Wesley Hyatt saw that ad, thought, you know, I can do that, and he built a workshop in his backyard and spent a number of years experimenting with different materials and eventually came up with this sort of semi-synthetic material, celluloid, which was the first really easily manipulatable plastic.
And he was putting together a whole bunch of molecules.
He was putting together a whole bunch of molecules. I mean, what he was doing, you know, literally was he was taking cotton, which is a plant cellulose. It's a natural polymer. And he was mixing it with camphor and I think camphor and one other material, nitrocellulose, to create celluloid. And he got this material that kind of was like shoe leather, but more malleable.
So did he get the money from the New York Billiard Supply Company?
No, as far as anyone knows, he didn't. And what's more, celluloid didn't turn out to be a very good material for billiard balls. The story goes that celluloid is a very flammable, volatile material, and apparently when billiard balls knocked into each other, they would make this kind of shotgun-like crack. And apparently some saloon keeper in Denver wrote him and said, you know, this is happening. I don't mind so much, but every time it happens, every man in the bar draws a gun.
But billiard balls are made out of plastic, aren't they? A different kind of plastic?
You know, they're made. Some of them are made out of bakelite, which was another early plastic, also invented to replace a natural material, in that case, shellac. And then I don't know what modern billiard balls are made out of.
Well, I know they're pretty cheap. And this is kind of like the gift of the Magi. At one time, billiards was a gentleman's game. Once plastic came in, it democratized things, and it caused all that trouble in River City.
Exactly right. I mean, plastic really did sort of democratize consumer goods at a time that you had this rising middle class with, you know, interest in acquiring more things.
Was Bakelite developed because cellulose had, or celluloid, I guess it is, had so many limitations?
No, really, Bakelite, again, like celluloid, was developed in response to a perceived shortage. In that case, it was a shortage of shellac. Shellac is, I didn't actually know this till I wrote the book, shellac actually is comes from the a resin produced by the lac beetle, and it is a quite involved process, taking that and turning it into shellac. When it was just a decorative thing, that wasn't a big deal. But in the early 20th century, people discovered that shellac was really good as an electrical insulator. And this was at a time the country's wiring up like gangbusters. And the poor little lac beetles couldn't really keep up with the demand because it takes something like 15,000 beetles 6 months to create a pound of shellac. So Leo Bakeland, who was the inventor of Bakelite, set out to develop a synthetic material that could be used as an insulator.
And what was he using?
You know, he actually was using coal tar. So his, unlike celluloid, which started with a natural polymer, this cellulose that's from plants, Bakeland was using coal tar and using that to create what was a fully synthetic molecule. So it's considered the first really truly man-made plastic.
And did that change the way plastics were developed when people realized that you could do this thing out of without having original natural ingredients?
Well, his invention per se didn't, but what you also had happening was the rise of the petrochemical industry and of, you know, sort of oil refinery and chemical production. And both of those industries are industries that produce, in the process of refining oil, you throw off all these byproducts. And what the oil industry as well as the chemical industry got very good at was taking those byproducts and making them into new products, secondary products.
So is most of the plastic that we see today some byproduct of petroleum?
It's either oil or natural gas. In this country, actually, most plastic comes from natural gas. But yeah, it comes from byproducts that, you know, otherwise might be, you know, burned away.
My guest is Susan Frankel, Freinkel. Her latest book, Plastic, A Toxic Love Story, it's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. When these things started being developed, were they seen as a godsend for countries that didn't have the natural resources to produce things?
Well, the U.S. was really at the center of the plastics industry, but there was...
And we had the natural resources.
And we had the natural resources, but what they were seen as was this source of tremendous abundance. I mean, I quote these British chemists who were writing in the early 40s who looked at the rise of all these new plastic materials and saw, you know, the possibility of creating these materials basically out of waste, almost in, you know, to many people it seemed this almost magical process of, you know, creating abundance and all sorts of stuff out of waste. And so it was considered, wow, this might be an opportunity to escape this reliance on scarce natural resources.
But we see a quantum leap in the use of plastic at some point. What was it, World War II?
World War II was where you really ramped up plastic production. Most of the major plastics had been invented before the war. But what happened at the outset of the war was the U.S. military recognized that they could use plastic to substitute for various strategic metals. And so suddenly there was this call out to sort of this whole nascent developing plastic industry to start ramping up production, and plastic went into everything from, you know, the nylon for parachutes to the acrylic for the turrets of airborne gunners to polyethylene was used actually to shield radar. And so you had this huge production that was built up during the war.
Is nylon a plastic?
Nylon's a plastic. It's a polymer, yeah.
In 1968, the Museum of Contemporary Crafts put on an exhibit of items made of plastic. What kinds of things were represented?
That was a show that was a show looking at housewares, looking at furniture, looking at art. You know, by that time, plastic had pretty well become embedded into a lot of parts of people's lives. And so they were looking at the design and artistic capabilities
and
of
plastic. And how did the critics respond?
Well, I quote this critic, Hilton Kramer, from the New York Times, who was actually disappointed by the show. He said, you know, here's this family of materials that offer, in his phrase, an almost Faustian freedom for artists, you know, a family of materials that can be made to be anything that people want to match any artist's dream. And he felt that most of the artists were really kind of falling down on the job, that it was pretty prosaic art. He was more interested in what industrial designers were doing, particularly what furniture makers were doing with plastic. He thought that's where people were really exploiting the materials possibilities.
And has that been where some of the best work has been done?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been some really interesting work in plastic furniture. I talk about plastic chairs as a way to explore the design possibilities of plastic.
And isn't plastic brittle? Isn't a chair made of plastic likely to break at some point?
No, not necessarily. Again, plastic isn't one thing. There are so many different kinds of plastics, and you can engineer it to have the strength and durability that you want it to have. So for mid-20th century designers, saw plastic as an opportunity to create these marvelous forms in chairs that would be easily manufactured. And they saw it as a vehicle for bringing design, again, having a democratic possibility, bringing design to average people.
Listeners are writing in, and so far everything I see is negative about plastic. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the negatives. My guest is Susan Frankel. Her book, Plastic, A Toxic Love Story, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Stay with us. We're back with Susan Frankel, who's written a book called Plastic, A Toxic Love Story, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And that subtitle gives us some idea of what you're about here. This is one of those love-hate relationships, humans and plastics.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, what I think we forget for people of my generation, I was coming of age when the Graduate came out, and that's my association with plastic. So doing this book in some ways was a revelation to me to realize both that this really is a pretty wonderful family of materials. It's pretty amazing what we have learned to do and what we've become able to do. The problem is we often use them in really foolish, short-sighted, and wasteful ways. And so much plastic gets poured into so many kind of crappy applications that we lose sight of that, and you know, you end up with this kind of negative association.
And that's why a number of people have written in about plastic bags. There are some communities that have started charging people for the use of plastic bags. Now, why are they so bad?
Okay, plastic bags.
They're great for taking the newspapers out, and when you're recycling the newspapers, aren't they?
I don't know. We can't do that in San Francisco because they want the newspapers separate. But, you know, I live in San Francisco, which was the first city to ban plastic bags. Plastic bags, there are a lot of problems with plastic bags. The big problem with them really is that they're very flyaway. It's very easy for them to get into the environment. And when they do, they don't break down. They don't go away. You know, we've all seen them sort of hanging around forever, like, you know, bad party guests that will never, ever go away. I think they have also sort of taken on the symbolic importance as a kind of emblem for the environmental costs of our disposable society. And the fact that you just have this, you know, huge blizzard of bags, I mean, billions and billions of bags everywhere, whether you want them or not, all of us have our cupboards filled with plastic bags. It's a prime example of sort of a wasteful use of a resource.
Well, there are places, as you said, San Francisco, that have outlawed them. The Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda have moved to ban plastic bags, but not New York City and so many others.
Yeah.
Why? Yeah. Is there a plastic bag lobby?
Well, there is a plastic bag lobby. The American Chemistry Council, which represents the big producers of raw plastics, as well as ExxonMobil, which makes polyethylene, as well as the big bag manufacturers, have all been fighting these bans very hard. And, they have pointed out, I think rightly, that in places where you'd simply ban plastic bags, the default measure is paper bags, which are not necessarily an environmentally preferable option.
Now, what's the real problem here, that they're not biodegradable? Can plastic bags be invented that are biodegradable, that won't live until the dinosaurs return to Earth?
They can. But here's where you start. You know, this is where the plastics issues have all these complications that are hard to reconcile. The big problem with plastic bags is they hang around forever. If you replace those with biodegradable bags, bags that can break down, that sounds like a great thing, but only if you have a way to throw away those biodegradable bags in a place where they will biodegrade. So if you live in a city where you have a program for composting organic waste, then you can put those biodegradable bags in your compost bin, and there will be a way of making sure that they break down and compost. If you're simply putting them in the trash and sending them to landfill, that's actually probably even worse than if they're just conventional plastic bags, because in a landfill, if a biodegradable bag starts to break down, it will produce methane, which is an even more potent greenhouse gas than CO2.
Another listener asks, I refill my plastic water bottle with New York City tap water several times a day. Is that healthy?
The danger that I've heard about refilling just your regular plastic bottle is that they're not easily washed. And it's not so much that there's a danger from the plastic, but that you're getting bacteria from your mouth into the water.
But many people are concerned about DEHP.
Okay, that's not in plastic bottles. DEHP is a chemical called a phthalate, which is in vinyl. It's used to make vinyl soft and flexible. So it's something that you would find in, I write about IV bags and blood bags, which contain DEHP, but you would find it in any kind of soft vinyl, from your shower curtain to your garden hose.
And DEHP is not good for us, and we're putting it in the IV bags that is supposed to help people get healthier?
Well, this is a very troubling thing, obviously. I mean, here's the quick story on DEHP and vinyl. DEHP is a chemical, it's a member of a family of chemicals called phthalates. And there is a lot of evidence, both through animal studies and, well, let's start with animal studies, that show high doses of those, of DEHP, is really toxic to the male reproductive system. It can affect, you know, fertility. It can affect how the testicles develop and so forth. The big question is what happens in small doses, which is what we're exposed to through things like IV bags or other kind of vinyl objects.
But wouldn't DEHP be present in those plastic bottles that they sell water for at inflated prices in the store and in all of the Tupperware containers that we get our food in and then sometimes reheat it the microwave?
See, again, we use the word plastic, but what we're really talking about is a lot of different materials that can be as different from one another as glass from paper.
But they are pliable and they're...
They are pliable, but just, you know, to go through to make it clear, water bottles are made of a plastic called PET. The Tupperware containers, that Tupperware is made of polyethylene, same variety, same family as plastic bags. Yogurt containers, a lot of deli takeout containers are made of polypropylene. Each of those is a different kind of plastic with its own properties and is processed in separate ways and takes different kinds of additives. And so the health issues related to those can be quite different.
Daniel, a listener, asks, hasn't plastic had a revolutionizing effect on medical treatment?
Absolutely. Plastic, you could not have modern medicine without plastic. My mother broke her hip this spring. I was in the hospital with her, and I realized it was like the most plastic environment I had ever been in, maybe outside of a preschool. Plastic is everywhere.
They put those gloves on?
They put those gloves on. It's on the floors. It's on the beds. You know, with my mother, it was in her hip. Mm-hmm. You could not practice medicine without plastic.
On the other hand, a caller mentions that gift shops at the Grand Canyon are using plastic bags, and bags can be seen down in the canyon and also hang off trees in the area.
Yeah, that's depressing. That's depressing to hear.
My guest is Susan Frankel, Freinkel. Her book, Plastic, A Toxic Love Story, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When I think about items made of plastic, the first thing that comes to mind are toys. Aren't almost all toys these days made of plastic?
Yeah. One toy manufacturer said to me, plastic is like air in the toy industry. And I you know, when I started, the book is organized around different objects that tell different stories of plastic. And for the toy, I spent time in Toys R Us, and I realized, oh, my God, there is nothing that's not plastic here, which certainly wasn't the case when I was growing up.
Well, one of my producers made her kids go through their room and throw out half their toys, and the ones the kids chose to throw out were the handmade wooden lobster pull toy from Maine, but they insisted on keeping the plastic figures from their Happy Meals. Why do kids love plastic toys so much? Is it the color? Is it the fact that they enjoy biting it when they're younger?
I think it's all those things. I mean, my oldest son, when he was born, someone gave us this beautiful cherry wood rattle, and he wanted nothing to do with it. He wanted the little, you know, brightly colored keys. I think, you know, they're bright, they're smooth, they're pleasing to touch. Those are all the qualities that are attractive to kids.
Well, wood eventually deteriorates, but should I assume that there'll be a lot of Fisher-Price items that will be outliving us all?
Yeah. There will be, you know, if we don't start to deal with plastic, what'll happen is, you know, 500 years from now, people will dig down in landfills and find, you know, this layer that is all plastic.
And for this book, you decided to follow the production of a single toy. You chose the Frisbee?
Yeah, I chose the Frisbee because it was made of polyethylene, which is the most common plastic. And, you know, and frankly, partly was because I could get into both a polyethylene plant and Wham-O agreed to let me go to their Frisbee factory.
I've always wondered why something like Frisbee survives as long as it does, whereas the hula hoop doesn't.
Yeah. So the toy industry apparently is very brutal. I think the reason the Frisbee became such a classic toy is that Wham-O made this very smart decision where they said, you know, yeah, this is a great kind of novelty item, but you could build whole sports around them. And that's really where the staying power for the Frisbee is.
And you went to a Dow Chemical plant. I would have thought Dow Chemical would be rather uneasy after all the bad press they got during the Vietnam War.
Dow was very uneasy. When I first approached them about touring, they said, you know, we don't do public tours anymore. Actually, it was 9/11 when they stopped doing public tours because they are in the Gulf region. It's considered a strategic location. And I contacted somebody I knew who worked with Dow, and I said, you know, do you think you can help me get into the plant? And he said, I can help you, but you're going to have to promise not to say anything negative about Dow in the book. And I sort of thought about it, and I realized this was a chapter that was just nuts and bolts. I didn't have to go into Dow's corporate history.
And they do a lot of different kinds of plastics. Saran wrap, isn't that Dow?
Yes, Saran wrap is. Wraps? Yeah, yeah. But the plant I visited, they were producing something like, I think, close to 20 different either plastics or the sort of base ingredients for plastic.
And that was in China?
No, the Dow plant was down in Freeport, Texas, which is, you know, it's all the Gulf region.
But the Frisbees are made in China, aren't they?
The Frisbees at that time, they were contracting with a company in China. And since I visited there, new corporate owners took over Wham-O. They claim they're making Frisbees in the U.S. I'm not sure that that's true. I've been told by other people that they're still doing it in China.
Catherine in Brooklyn writes, even if you bring your own bag to the grocery store, there's still the clear plastic bags for fruits and vegetables. So how do you get around that?
There's different ways you can get around it. I try pretty hard not to take plastic bags. So I just actually take produce loose and I just put it into my reusable bag, and it probably drives the cashiers crazy. You can also buy like cloth bags, or you could take the produce bag that you took last week and bring it back to the store.
Do you think a tax on plastic bags would work? We now pay, in this city anyway, 5 cent deposit on plastic bottles, and people don't bother returning them to be recycled. They just simply throw them out.
Well, I think, I don't call it a tax. I call it a fee, because a tax is mandatory and a fee is voluntary. But, I do think it works. In Washington, D.C., they put a 5 cent fee on bags, and bag use dramatically dropped. I think that actually is the best way to deal with bags is, you know, people may want to use them. I know in New York you've got small apartments. People use them for their trash. But if you have to pay for them, you might think harder about whether you really need this bag.
We've talked a lot about the plastic soups in the various oceans around the world. But you do address that issue. And you focused on disposable lighters. That's not something that we usually talk about in that discussion.
That's true. I focused on disposable lighters for a couple of reasons. One is it is really a fully disposable object. I mean, the plastic disposable lighter replaced matches, which you get for free, which break down, or Zippos, which are refillable and repairable. And, you know, they come with literally a lifetime guarantee. Plastic lighter, by contrast, you can't reuse it, you can't refill it, and you can't recycle it. It can only be thrown away. But part of the reason I also picked the lighter was two things. One is I knew they'd been found in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. In fact, I talked to a researcher who said, you know, you can see on my website a guy who had gone to that part of the ocean to do research. And he said, you know, I've got a picture of one we fished out on my website. And there it was. And you could see the address of the place in China that had been, you know, distributing them. And also you've got they're a common object that's found in the carcasses of albatrosses who live on Midway. They have their rookeries there, and the birds scavenge for food, and part of their feeding grounds is the area that we call the garbage patch in the Pacific Ocean, and a lot of them come back with plastic lighters.
Are there any organisms that benefit from the growing presence of plastic in the oceans?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about it as bad, but what's really happening is it's changing and altering the marine ecosystem. And in point of fact, all these microorganisms attach themselves to the little plastic floating bits that are in the ocean. You find if you pull up big clumps of plastic, you find all these gooseneck barnacles and other things on the bottom of them. It's changing the ocean ecosystem in ways that we don't really know.
Haven't there been studies that suggest that paper may be worse environmentally than plastic?
Well, that's the issue that often comes up around the plastic bag debate, because the default position with if you get rid of plastic bags is grocery stores go back to paper. And again, it depends on what your goal is here. Paper is it takes more energy and water to produce. It produces, you know, there's greater greenhouse gas emissions in the transport of paper bags. They're more expensive to store. On the other hand, you know, if a paper bag gets lost in the park, it's going to eventually go away.
Can we realistically get rid of plastic?
No, and we don't want to. I am, plastic is really important to modern life for so many different things. I mean, as I mentioned, in medicine, it's essential in electronics. It's essential in cars. If we want lighter weight cars and planes that won't take as much gas, plastic is the key to that. It's, you know.
But we're using gas to make the planes that don't use as much gas.
Well, we're locked into, you know, we're locked into a crazy lifestyle. But we don't want to get rid of plastic. What we want to do is not use it so stupidly. Half of all plastic goes to single use and disposable items. That's where the big waste is.
And what about, can we eliminate some of the plastics that do have a negative impact on the environment or on our bodies?
You know, that's the source of a big fight.
Because we don't know, I'm assuming we don't know, what actually went into the making of the plastics that we are using. We're putting food in a microwave and then heating up.
That's a big problem. In dealing with the toxins in plastics, you're right. We don't know what the ingredients are in plastics. We don't know what additives are added. There's no label on the side that says, you know, this product contains X, Y, and Z. And unfortunately, the laws in this country are very weak, and they don't really require manufacturers to demonstrate a given synthetic chemical is going to be safe before it goes into commerce. It's presumed safe until shown to be otherwise. And you know, as consumers, we can't get around that. You know, we can try to be careful, but until we have tougher chemical laws, we are still really living in a black box.
But it also applies to other things like cleaning sprays.
Absolutely.
We just have to change the way we write these laws.
We do. And then, you know, there's an effort underway right now. Frank Lautenberg is one of the main sponsors of a law to toughen the chemical laws.
Susan Frankel has written for The New York Times, Discover, Smithsonian, Health, among other magazines. Her book is Plastic, A Toxic Love Story. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.